TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Jonathan Haidt with Tristan Harris, The Epidemic of Childhood Mental Illness. Excessive screen time on phones coincides with a sharp increase in depression, anxiety, and self-harm in young people. Jonathan Haidt is the author of The Anxious Generation, published in March 2024. He's in conversation with Tristan Harris, an ex-employee of Google. Harris had a key role in the Netflix documentary film The Social Dilemma and explained how the design of social media platforms manipulates people's views, emotions, and behavior. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club of California, Jonathan Haidt and Tristan Harris appeared together on stage on April 1st, 2024. Ken Broad is giving the introduction.
Now it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's guest. Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist and he's a Thomas Cooley Professor in Ethical Leadership at New York University. He's personally one of my favorite public intellectuals and authors. He was here back in September of 2018 for a talk on how colleges are failing kids. So he's really further backed up into K-12. Since 2018, he's been studying the disastrous consequences of social media, both on teenage mental health, as well as the rise of political dysfunction, which I believe is the topic of his next book. The Anxious Generation, the subtitle is How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness, directly related. Not only explores the dangers facing teenagers, but it's a call to action for what parents, teachers, schools, tech companies, and government must collectively do to end the crisis. And importantly, has some very concrete suggestions that we can all take away. Starting the conversation tonight is Tristan Harris. He's co-founder and executive director for the Center for Humane Technology, a longtime critic of Silicon Valley's War for Our Attention. They're a co-sponsor tonight, and this is really a doubleheader. This is going to be an amazing conversation, so I'm glad you're all here. Please join me in welcoming Tristan Harris first, and then we'll have Jonathan Haidt come up.
Thank you so much, Ken, for hosting all of us here in the Commonwealth Club. It's good to see all of you. We're really honored to have this event. John is someone I've admired for a very long time, even before The Social Dilemma, which he and I were both in. How many people here have seen The Social Dilemma? Wow. I guess it makes sense. It's a higher percentage than normal. How many people here are parents? We can look around the room. This is a lot of parents in the audience. How many people here are teachers or educators? Quite a number of those as well. Any tech company executives in the room? It's okay. You can raise your hand. Okay, good. So I say that because, you know, we really care about how we change these issues. It's easy to get caught admiring the problem. And we really care about how we change these issues. And the thing that I respect so much about John's latest book, The Anxious Generation, is it's all about what we can do about it. And the stakes are high. The health of a civilization depends on the health of the upbringing of its children. And if we have a problem at the foundation of our society, we have to clean that up to have a future. And I also wanted to say that much like, you know, we at the Center for Humane Technology, we focus on incentives. You know, in 2013, when I made this presentation that went viral at Google about how technology was going to be influencing the global climate change of culture, it was all about focusing on the incentives. Charlie Munger, who is Warren Buffett's business partner, said, "If you show me the incentive, I will show you the outcome." And I think the key thing that John and CHT are both sort of interested in is how do perverse incentives and the lack of coordination to change them create a more problematic outcome for society? Because a race for engagement and the race to the bottom of the brainstem was predictably going to create a more addicted, distracted, lonely, sexualized society, because that's where the incentive takes us. But what John is offering us with his book is a crystal clear case of all of the research that makes it clear where those harms are showing up to make it definitive so we can hopefully make another choice. And before we start supercharging every perverse incentive we have in the world with artificial intelligence, it is so important that we are able to spot those perverse incentives before we push double exponential power through those perverse incentives. So with no further ado, I'd like to invite John Haidt, a very deep hero of mine and friend, up to the stage to give a presentation on some of that research. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Tristan. And thank you, Ken and Jackie. Ken and Jackie have supported my work at NYU Stern, and they've brought so many authors here to San Francisco. They're just great patrons of ideas, and so we're very grateful to you. Thank you. So a question for you. Tristan asked a bunch of questions about who we have in the audience. How many of you feel as though somehow things are spiraling out of control? You have a vague sense that things are getting weirder and weirder. Raise your hand. Okay. So you're right. They are. And if we go back to like 2011, 2012, when we were all such techno-optimists, at least most of us, you know, the internet had been so amazing, you know, godlike powers of knowledge in the 90s, and the fall of the Berlin Wall was just before that, so the internet was like, you know, the new age of democracy, and it's gonna knock down all the dictators, it's gonna be amazing. All the way to 2011, the Arab Spring. So most of us were techno-optimists, I certainly was. The future looked incredibly bright compared to millions of years of war and famine and things like that. And that's part of the reason why I think we missed what was happening to our kids, because we kind of thought, this is amazing, and the kids are immersing themselves in it. What could go wrong? And I'm starting this way because one of the first people to see that this wasn't what was going to happen was Tristan. First, when he was working at Google, and he gave this talk, this internal PowerPoint talk about, hey, you know, we're sucking up everybody's attention around the world. And what's gonna happen if no one has any more attention to do anything? This is probably not a good thing. And that was 2013. And he's been, because he understands the complexity, not just of the technology, which a lot of people do, but Tristan is a really deep abstract thinker who's able to think about the complexity of society as a social scientist or sociologist would as well. So it's been, I'm really grateful to him. It's been really amazing for me to work with him on The Social Dilemma. We met before then. So I was very excited to get this invitation to speak with Tristan to you. What we're going to do first, though, is I think it's very helpful to lay out what has happened to young people, what has happened to people born after 1995. People born after, let's say, 1997, on average, have a very different profile from people born, say, in 1993. It changed very, very suddenly. So I'm going to just go through a few slides. Now, I'm aware that my slides and graphs will be great for you here in the room, and they'll be great for those who are going to be watching the video that will be made, perhaps on YouTube, and not so good for the people listening on the podcast. So I'll try to sort of, you know, explain the overview of each slide without going into too much detail. But I want to start, Ken told me there's a bunch of educators and teachers in the audience. I want to start, I'll just lay out just the thesis, and then I'm going to start with what has happened to education. So my argument in brief is that humans had a play-based childhood for millions of years, because that's what mammals do. All mammals play, they have to play to wire up their brains. But that play-based childhood began to fade out in the 1980s in the United States, and it was gone by 2010. And that's because right around 2010 is when the phone-based childhood sweeps in. Our children are now raised largely with a phone at the center of everything. And let's talk about what happened when that change happened. Another way I can summarize my book is by saying we have overprotected our children in the real world, and we have underprotected them online, and both of those are mistakes. So a month or two ago, Derek Thompson, a great data writer in the data analyst in The Atlantic, had an article when the PISA scores came out. PISA is the one global assessment of how students are doing around the world. 15-year-olds, how are they doing academically? And what Derek pointed out, which people were seeing in this new data, is that scores in math and reading and those were all fairly steady. And then all of a sudden, after 2012, they drop. So that's international. Around the world, our young people are, I shouldn't quite say getting stupider, but they're not learning as much as they would have a few years before. I wonder why. And then Derek didn't include this, but this is another data set we have. This is called the Nation's Report Card, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And here you can track what happened in the United States. From the 70s to 2012, it's slow. I mean, to raise the intelligence or the academic progress of an entire nation is really, really hard. But we were doing it. We were doing it. Slow, steady progress in math and reading. until 2012, and then it drops. Now everyone says, oh, COVID was so terrible. Yeah, and it was. And you can see that the drop with COVID is substantial. But the drop didn't begin with COVID. Our students began learning less after 2012. This is when the change happens. Now I'll transition to what my book is more about, which is the mental health. But my point is, across almost any assessment you want to make, Gen Z, born 1996 and later, is doing poorly. And it's very sudden. It happened very suddenly in the early 2010s. I first saw this on college campuses. Greg Lukianoff actually was one of the first to spot it. Something was changing about students who arrived in 2014 compared to, say, those who arrived in 2012. Up through 2012, they were all millennials. But as we go on in the decade, you see a number of things rise a little bit. ADHD is up a little bit, learning disability up a tiny bit. But it's really this yellow line, which is psychological disorders. That's what rises fast. That's the big difference between Gen Z and the millennials, is that Gen Z has very high rates of mental illness, especially depression and anxiety. This is data from collected from university health systems, and what we see is, so these are US undergraduates with a variety of conditions, and all the graphs that I show, if you track the data up through 2010, you see nothing. That is, even in the 90s and especially the 2000s, mental health was not getting worse, and on some measures it was getting a little better. The millennials actually were a little more mentally healthy than Gen X before them. Gen X is 1965 through 1980. But what you see as we go on into the 2010s is this. Everything goes up, but it's especially depression and anxiety. They are now at such high levels, it's just a normal part of being a teenager in the United States, but it's just a normal part of being a young person now, that you are depressed and anxious. It's not that the majority is, but it's almost. I mean, it's around 30-40% are depressed and anxious. This graph shows that it's actually just the young people, because as we go on in this period, what you see is that the lines for older people don't really change, but the youngest generation is really where the increase is concentrated. The rise is also gendered in a lot of ways. It's boys and girls are doing much worse than they were before, but often the rise is larger for girls. Now, note in this case, the percentage increase is actually slightly higher for boys, but they start at a much lower level. So they go from about 5% to 12% had a major depression in the last year. A big increase percentage-wise, but you wouldn't say, you know, oh, boys, it's just normal for them to be depressed. They're not. It's 12%. Whereas for girls, it went from 12% up to nearly 30%. Which is a very large portion of our girls have had a major depressive episode in the last year. And I want you to notice, the data for 2022 just came in about 2 months ago, and I was able to add it to the graph. You can kind of see the COVID effect there if you look closely. See, COVID made things a little bit worse, but it really just, it went right back to the trend line. COVID is trivial compared to whatever happened in the early 2010s. And it's not just that they're saying that they're depressed and anxious. When we look at measures of behavior, this shows it's actually emergency room visits. This is for self-harm. Emergency room visits for self-harm. Again, no trend before 2010, and then after 2010, girls go way, way up, especially preteen girls. The CDC divides the data up into two age groups. The younger age group is almost always where you see the biggest percentage increase. Something really, really hit 10 to 14-year-old girls very hard in this country in the early 2010s. And it's not just self-harm, it's also suicide, which boys commit more suicide than girls. They tend to use lethal means such as a gun or a tall building. Girls make many more attempts. But when we look at actual deaths, what we see is a very large and sudden increase. I mean, this is quite astonishing. Between 2012 and 2013, the suicide rate for young teen girls went up 67% in a single year. And it wasn't a blip. It wasn't like an error that it went down the next year. It was the first leg of a rise up to 134% increase. And it's not just us. It's happening in very much the same way in all of the English-speaking countries. This is Britain for self-harm. We see the same pattern. And this is Australia's psychiatric emergency department visits. Again, no trend before 2010. And then afterwards, way up for boys and for girls. Same in New Zealand. Similar data from Scandinavia. It's not all over the world. It's not. We don't see this in East Asia. But it is all over Northern Europe and the English-speaking countries and North America. Now, why? Why would this pattern be happening in so many countries at the same time. Everyone has a theory. People hit me with all kinds of theories to explain it. And I say, fine, that might work for the United States, but why did that cause girls in Australia to start cutting themselves? It doesn't make any sense. And I think there is really only one theory on the table. I keep waiting for someone to propose another. Nobody has, which is what I call the great rewiring of childhood. It happened in two phases, as I said, the end of the play-based childhood and then the birth of the phone-based childhood. I'll just show you a few more slides and then I'll invite Tristan up and we'll continue the conversation. Something I didn't realize until I really got deep into writing the book, you find this graph at Our World in Data. They graph out how adoption of various technologies. And there's for communication technologies, because they're network issues, there's always a brief period where everyone is getting it. You know, once some people are getting a telephone, you have a point, everyone now is getting a telephone, that sort of thing. And what we see is that the first wave, the personal computer, so many, you know, older people like me remember when you got your first IBM PC, or out here, I guess you would have gotten a Mac, whatever. So, you know, that was adopted, and you could do WordStar and, other things like that. But it's not until you get dial-up internet that it really becomes useful. And then that rises very fast in the 90s and into the 2000s. And that first wave was wonderful. It was magical. It didn't do anything bad to mental health. It corresponded with the period of the greatest growth in democracy ever. So we were all techno-optimists. This stuff is great, isn't it? But it's this second wave. This is what did in Gen Z, at least in my telling in the book. It was the beginning of social media, which we used to call social networking systems, because it was a way you would just connect and you'd share your profile. Social networking systems are adopted very, very rapidly, even before the smartphone. But once the smartphone comes out as well, those two together are by far the fastest technological adoption in history, although I think maybe ChatGPT might have been faster. I don't know. I don't have the data. But this transformed things just in the blink of an eye. And this is exactly when teen mental health plummets, and also democracy, which may or may, democracy reached a high point around 2011, 2012, and now it's been drifting downward, the number of democracies and their quality. So I'll just to illustrate, childhood used to be, all of older people, I'm sure your fondest memories are not, with your parents, and they're not sitting watching TV. They're probably, you're outside playing, you're having adventures. It used to be just for younger people in the audience. If you look at the bottom left picture, it used to just be a thing that you could ride around town in a bicycle with an extraterrestrial in your basket. It's just something, it's just something that we did. Whereas now, childhood is basically this. If you're a boy and you want to play video games with your friends, you have to go home alone. You can't go over to your friend's house. You need your headset, your controller, your screen. So childhood now is much more solitary than it ever has been in human history. And the results, I think, are not good. So there are so many different avenues of harm. In fact, in our brief time, I barely have time to just read them. I'll just read them for the audience listening in. The opportunity cost, kids are on for 9 hours a day, 5 hours a day of which is social media, social deprivation, sleep deprivation, attention fragmentation, behavioral addiction. Those affect everyone, boys and girls. Then I have a whole chapter on why social media harms girls more. Girls are more sensitive. Boys and girls are just a little different in their social needs. And so I'll just list them. Visual social comparison, perfectionism, relational aggression. Girls share emotions more than boys, including anxiety and sadness. Girls are more susceptible to sociogenic transmission, especially via TikTok. And girls are more subject to sexual predation and harassment. It's just more part of your daily life online if you're a girl that you're approached by older men with bad intent. But the boy story is a little more complicated, not quite as obvious, but my research associate Zach Rausch and I think we worked it out pretty well, drawing on Richard Reeves' book of Boys and Men, that boys have just been withdrawing from effort in the real world since the 80s, 70s or 80s, and getting lured ever more into the virtual world where they can get their desires for coalitional violence, that is war and sports, pretend. You can get your desires for that sort of play satisfied in video games and your desire for sex from pornography. So boys are just retreating from the real world. So we get rising levels of porn addiction. Multiplayer video games take up a huge amount of time. They're great fun. They're incredibly immersive. And so anyway, the point is boys' lives have been upended too. It doesn't show up as much in depression and anxiety. It shows up as just withdrawing from effort in the real world. Boys are just not really doing the things. They're not making the efforts and experiencing the failures and setbacks that would strengthen them to grow into men. Tristan and I will talk about this, but there's actually a way out, because almost all the parents hate what's going on. All the teachers hate what's going on. All the principals and heads of school hate what's going on. And guess what? Gen Z hates what's going on. They see it. They're not in denial. They really see that they're trapped. And you say, well, you know, why do you waste your life this way? Why don't you just get off? I can't, because everyone else is on. So it's a social dilemma. It's a collective action problem. And so what I'm proposing as the way out is, if we all just agree to adopt four norms, even if Congress never comes to our aid, even if Congress never does a damn thing to fix the mistakes it made in the 90s that set us up for this, including not just requiring no age verification, but saying, oh, and by the way, you can't sue the companies either. They have blanket protection from lawsuits for what they do to our kids. So even if Congress never fixes the mistake, and I should say, there is real hope for a bill, COSA, the Kids Online Safety Act. That is the one thing that Congress might do. State legislatures, including Florida and Utah, are actually doing, I think, a great job of trying out approaches that actually will make a difference. But if we just do these four norms, if nobody gives their kid a smartphone before high school, just give them a flip phone. That's what the millennials had, and they were fine. Okay, some of you may not think so, but in terms of the mental health data, the millennials were fine. No social media before 16. That's going to be the hardest one to do, and that's where we really could use legislative help. But we can do it even without that. Phone-free schools. This is an absolute. This one is easy. This one is the biggest bang for the buck. This one can be done all over the country by this September. You just buy phone lockers or Yonder pouches, and you need the phone to get to and from school. I understand that. But if anything that can text must be locked up, because if they have anything, including a Chromebook, if they have anything that can text, and some kids are texting, they all have to be texting, because nobody wants to be the only one who didn't know about the thing that happened in third period. So we have to go phone-free schools, and the kids love it once they detox. After a couple weeks, their brains actually enjoy talking to other kids. And we need much more childhood independence and free play. If we're going to greatly reduce screen time for kids, we have to give them back something fun, something normal, which is play with each other, hanging out with each other, having adventures with each other. And just a final note, I teamed up with Eric Schmidt, who has a variety of concerns about AI as a technologist, and then me as a social psychologist. We wrote an essay laying out how, set aside the risks of whether AI is going to become sentient and wipe us all out. Like, let's just put all that stuff aside. Let's just look at what social media is currently doing to children and democracy. What's going to happen as now everybody can use AI to fake everybody else? What's going to happen? It's going to get even worse for kids, even worse for democracy. So that's an argument that we made that Tristan and I will, I'm sure, we'll be talking about in just a moment. And so that's my presentation to you. My argument is that the play-based childhood was replaced by the phone-based childhood, that we have overprotected our kids in the real world and underprotected them online. We have to reverse that. And that's it. I welcome Tristan. Thank you.
Just a quick personal question, because it's something that I've actually wrestled with in this, is when you're with the scale of the stats that you just mentioned, mm-hmm. like, just curious, on a personal level in your own nervous system, how do you hold some of the implications of those graphs?
Yeah. Well, sometimes there's a scene in Jurassic Park where they come to the island, and then they first see the dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little bit like that. It's like, because I was not supposed to write this book. I had a contract to write a book on what social media was doing to democracy.
I remember.
It's going to be called Life After Babel, Adapting to a World We May Never Again Share. And I wrote the first chapter, which was the first chapter of this book. I wrote the first chapter laying out all the graphs. And it was like, what? Like, because once I realized it was not just us, it was international. Mm-hmm. That's where I felt like, wait, there's something really, really big going on here. And how do I handle it personally? Well, you know, compared to the concerns you and I have shared about the decline and possible collapse of democracy, you know, the loss of a generation is just kind of, you know, more of the same.
I think there is something to just the scale of, I'm sharing this because I think for me in looking at these issues, just like you, I struggle with it. Like I struggle when I was at Google and I saw that this was going to go to billions of people, these incentives. And I felt in my own nervous system, and in fact, my co-founder Aza of the Center for Humane Technology, we used to call it getting pre-TSD. What? That instead of post-traumatic stress disorder, it was like having pre-traumatic
this trauma is coming.
Stress.
Yeah.
Well, and it was just a personal question because it motivates me to say this has to stop.
Yeah.
Like this has to stop. Like what more evidence do we really need? And the next question I had for you is, I know you've been getting a bunch of critiques from academics and from other folks who want to question the data, say we've had many moral panics. Mm-hmm. If you were just to briefly sort of steelman or sort of respond to any of the critiques that are remaining. I can't imagine based on the clarity of what you've presented, but what are people saying?
Sure. There are two main critiques from other researchers. The main one is this is just another moral panic. The kids are okay. The null hypothesis is true. This is correlation, not causation. That's the standard view. That's what they've said. And you could defend that in 2019, I think, when I really entered this debate. But since then, it's become clear, actually, no, the kids are not all right, and it's true internationally, and most of them acknowledge that. And now there are a lot of experiments. It's not just correlation. It was mostly correlational before, but now there are, Zach Roush and I have collected, I think 25 experiments, 16 of which show significant effects. And the ones that don't, it's because they use short time intervals, not enough time to detox the brain. So I think now there's a lot of experimental evidence. And then the other thing just occurred to me recently, because, you know, they're right that we should be concerned about a moral panic. And in many ways, like I hear myself talking, I look at my writing, and I do sound just like the people that they point to from 50 and 100 and 2,000 years ago.
Right.
So in a sense, yes, there is a moral panic, and I am fomenting it. But if it's actually happening, then you would say that I'm an alarm ringer, not an alarmist.
Right, exactly.
So, and then the final point is, in every previous moral panic, one of the features is lurid stories about this thing that happened. A kid smoked marijuana and then he chopped off his parents' head or whatever, you know, some thing. And, you know, I read it in a newspaper.
Right.
And oh my God, this is terrible. Okay, and so, you know, maybe, you know, most of them didn't happen, maybe some did. This one is entirely different. As I go around, you know, almost every journalist who interviews me, either before the interview or during the interview, they say, you know, I've seen this in my own kids.
Yeah.
Or I've seen this in my kids' friends. Everyone sees it. This is not lurid examples trumped up to make people afraid.
Right.
Everyone sees it now.
Yeah.
That's Jonathan Haidt, the author of The Anxious Generation, published in March 2024. He spoke with former Google employee Tristan Harris, who said that social media platforms manipulate people's views, emotions, and behavior. This was a 24-minute excerpt of their conversation at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on April 1st, 2024. For the full hour recording that also shows the images of the graphs that present the specific data for mental illness, the decline in reading and math scores, and the proof that this has become an international phenomenon, go to the website of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can also search for the film on YouTube under the title Jonathan Haidt, The Anxious Generation and the Epidemic of Childhood Mental Illness. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.